Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Blizzard Comedy Chat. Today we are speaking to the marvellous Raoul Coley. Now if you've seen Raoul before, you'll know he is a fantastic comedian. I really enjoyed having this chat. There's a huge amount of political insight we delve into here, talking about how the political landscape has shifted since we both started doing comedy around the time of the London Olympics. And yes, some really, really interesting topics covered in this chat, both inside and outside of comedy. We also talk about what it's like doing comedy full time as opposed to everyone else we've had on the show so far, who are all fantastic comedians, but all of us don't do it as our main source of income, whereas Raoul does, or certainly did before comedy stopped. Had some really interesting chats about that, and also the effect of alcohol and other addictions on your life as a full-time comedian. So yes, really, really interesting and deep discussion here. I won't bore you too much more now. Let's get right into the chat. Thank you very much and enjoy.
Do you do comedy full time? So, like, have you got any other job at the minute, or are you completely fucked for income?
Well, I did, Johnny. I can rub it in my face.
No.
I did do comedy full time, and then the virus came, and now I don't do it at all. These little podcasts and interviews are the closest I get to reliving my former glory days. I'll probably have to go back home and work in my dad's corner shop.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Converted to a few things, you know. I've got a few YouTube videos I'm going to put out, a few YouTube series ideas.
Oh, awesome!
Geordie Laura's one about like old folk tales from the Northeast.
Oh, that sounds really cool.
Put out.
Yeah,
and then really interesting stories like how we became known as Geordies, how we helped find Jimi Hendrix, how we helped end transatlantic slavery. That's a really good one.
I had no idea Newcastle had all this history.
Any idea about all these things, but Frederick Douglass is where he bought his freedom. I'm going to make a video about it, put it all on YouTube. And I've you know, diverted to script writing as well, but nothing that has, you know, nothing that pays immediately.
No, of course, yeah, just loads of projects going on at once that aren't going to amount to anything until everything's resumed. But at least you've got all that to kind of get on with, and then you've got all those projects kind of release when you're able to.
Yeah, that's true. That's one thing I've realised as well, again, in the way that's changed my perception, is I've always wished the sort of world would stop a little bit so I could catch up on loads of things I have done on my to-do list.
Yeah.
And I've now realised, no matter how long the world stops for, and how long I'm alive, I will always have things to do. That to-do list will never be empty.
Okay, it's such a weird thing. I had so many ideas for projects I wanted to do, but I just needed like the time and the freedom to do it. And now that I've got that, I'm just like, I can't be bothered. I just want to play games and not do anything.
Yeah. You sort of get to see why Jojo Ramon still not wins a win here.
Yeah. Valid.
It's one of those things, isn't it? It's sort of a bit like global warming in a little sense, in the sense that, like, you know, there's so much to do with it that you just sort of give up looking at it. You just say, there is far too much. I think you need to set yourself certain limits. At least that helps me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because otherwise, you have like all these different ideas and then never execute any of them. So I'm like, fucking hell, there's like 27 different ideas I've got to do here. Fuck this. I'll play video games.
I definitely find that if I can commit to doing one specific thing, then I'll do it. But yeah, normally what it is I'll have like 12 projects on the go. I'll do a bit of one and then like, instead of continuing, I'll just start like five more. I'm really good at starting projects, not actually going through with any of them.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. If you were to split up comedy, I think you can split up comedy into three parts, really.
Yeah.
I think stand-up comedy can be split into three distinct parts. One is the ideas, the inspiration. Number two is the crafting of those inspirations into bits. And then number three is the stage presence and whatever you're doing with your delivery and all that. I am one who is just, I think you're Johnny as well, one that just... just loads of ideas, fucking 57 bits of inspiration within a second, and then just no way, shape, or form does curate or craft. Those bits that come to your head.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I can go like months without having any new ideas, and then I'll get all of them at once, and then I'll vaguely write them out, and then maybe actually one of them will end up being in like a polished enough state to work in a set. And then the rest of them will just haunt me for the rest of time.
Yeah, I'm the same. Like, I can write, I can write an hour set, and then when I try it out, and I try it out a few more times, eventually it'll be like a one-liner for the clubs.
Oh, God. Yeah, it's horrendous how much stuff you throw out. When did you first discover stand-up comedy? Now, not necessarily as a performer, just as something you enjoyed.
I think I was about 9, 10, or 11, really, was my first, like, vivid memory of discovering it.
Yeah.
My brother, okay, how do I tell you this without dry snitching on anyone? So, like, yeah, he worked at Blockbusters, but he also spent a lot of time online, and he had a big DVD collection that wasn't really the most legal. But anyway, with all these pirate DVDs, what they've made... with all these DVDs...
No one cares about pirate DVDs anymore, it's fine.
Still, it's my brother, isn't it? It's not me. But he does legal shit now and isn't like a bum like me, so... but anyway, all the DVDs and stuff like that he had and that he enjoyed and that I sort of started watching was probably what I now refer to as like Black Twitter.
Right.
There was like certain cultures that like he was really into hip hop.
Yeah.
So a lot of like African American TV and film ended up my way. That and pretty much like stoner films. So
yeah,
like
yeah.
Harold and Kumar, Half Baked with Dave Chappelle, and then like loads of films like Don't Be a Menace to South Central, Friday.
Yeah.
And one of the there was one comedy special he had. A few of them were Def Jam, but there was another one that he had. And the first one I remember watching was Chris Rock, Bigger and Blacker.
Yeah.
And I watched the full hour, and the only vivid memory I have is I remember watching his Bullet Control bit.
Yeah.
And thinking it was absolutely genius, thinking it was hilarious, and also wondering why we didn't implement it. I thought it was a really, really sensible policy.
Okay.
I was 10 at the time,
yeah.
But I was watching it, and I was like, why don't they do this in America? This is genius.
I don't
like,
think
this is a really, really good idea. Like, yeah, $3,000 a bullet. There would be no innocent bystander. He would take his property back. I thought it was genius.
Yeah.
So it was great policy. I thought it was hilarious. And that was probably my first, earliest memory of discovering stand-up comedy as an art form.
Right, yeah. So always kind of, so like, even from that very first kind of special, that was sort of very much the kind of like, sort of like politically leaning kind of comedy. Was that kind of your thing?
Politically leaning, but just like daftly solving problems,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
That is a problem.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
About within society.
Yeah.
And I think from that, like, I remember reading something a Simpsons writer said, where he said comedy's just like maths and physics. It's something that, in theory, is possible, but in practicality is just ludicrous.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely.
And actually, that doesn't necessarily fit for that bullet control joke.
Yeah.
Because I think that bullet control joke does actually work practically.
Yeah.
Perhaps there's a reason why it's really dumb, actually. but yeah, I think from that, like that formula, which is another formula sort of applied to my comedy, that you can see that in the first ever joke I ever really remember watching or listening to.
Yeah. What's the first ever joke you remember writing? Just out off the back of that, I'm just curious.
The first two jokes I wrote, I suppose, are a way of introducing myself.
Yeah.
I suppose in 2010, when I went to university and I was in freshly, and I was introducing myself to people, like, the two things I'd say is, like, Geordie Shore was really big at the time. It just started coming out. And then I would say, and when they'd ask what your parents do, I'd be like, I know it's a hilarious stereotype, but my dad owns a corner shop. And they were, like, the first sort of, like, vague memories I have of writing or, like, particularly coming up with something to say in the sense that, like, it works as a joke.
Yeah.
I mean, before that, there was a lot of storytelling.
Yeah, yeah.
But I never thought of like telling jokes as such until really I got sort of out of school.
Right, okay, yeah. So were you someone who was considered kind of socially funny like in school, like, in terms of that kind of like school hierarchy, were you someone who people found funny?
Not particularly in school. When I got to university, everyone thought I was funny, but in school I wasn't particularly known as funny. I was always up to something. I was always at schemes.
All right, yeah.
I ran a fight club. I ran a casino with, like, a roulette wheel in one of the classrooms.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, I was a club member at, like, 16, 17. Like, I ran my own club night at the nightclub. And the police came. They were, like, everyone looked underage. And they were, like, asking me about my ticket sellers and shit. And I was, like, if they ask me for ID, this whole thing falls at 17. So I was always up to something. But I was never necessarily diverting my attention to comedy. I think at first, in my younger years of my adolescence, I was more diverting my energy just staying out of the way. I was quite happy with where I was. Life was fairly easy.
Yeah.
And then, like, some kids like want the attention and they're like fucking the class clown. That wasn't me. I was like just trying to sleep at the back of the classroom and hope the teacher wouldn't ask questions. And that thus, you know, that really made me somebody who is not really trouble in the classroom or a funny man, because I'm trying to sky most of the time.
Yeah.
And then when I got a bit older, I wanted to just, you know, get fucked up. I think they're the inherent two combinations, but like the contradiction that makes me a comedian is that I think I really do enjoy challenging my brain. I really do enjoy coming up with like jokes and stuff like that, but I also enjoy like really fucking up my brain. Does that make sense? Like, I love playing Countdown High. That is for me a real fun pastime.
That makes a lot of sense.
Comedy pushes you to challenge yourself and be creative and graft as well, like particularly for me. I got no PR guy. I do all this shit myself. It requires that. I'm running a business here.
Yeah.
It does require some degree of organizational capacity. But it also, whenever I want, it allows me, by and large, unless I've got, you know, some contractually obligated, I've got a gig or something coming up, I can take fucking time off whenever I want, and that's quite liberating.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you do all your own booking and stuff, or did you have an agent?
I had an agent for about just under a year. I was with Adam Rushton, who's very good, to be fair.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Quite far in the circuit.
Yeah.
But for the vast majority of like my 8-9 year career, whatever it's been, I've been representing myself.
Fantastic. So how does it compare then? Like what's it like compared to like having an agent and booking your own stuff? What's like in terms of like an overall lifestyle?
It's complicated. I mean, you and your agent have got a gel and you got to have the same vision in mind. Know what I mean? Stuff like that. I'm happy to do anything, which is why me and Adam worked quite well together. At the time, it just wasn't really the right time financially. Like, I didn't have enough. I wasn't earning enough really back then to be giving 15% to an agent.
Right. Yeah. Valid.
I always say the worst thing to me as a comedian was going full time, because ever since I've gone full time, I'm like a lot less time is spent on the creativity and the crafting, and a lot more time is spent on the making sure you. Chasing up that promoter for your invoice or your next gig, or getting your flyers done for Edinburgh, making sure you've got the money to pay for Edinburgh watching, all that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean?
That absolutely makes sense. I suppose it's kind of I forgot the point I was going to make there, that's definitely a thing I would struggle with, like why I have no desire to go full time, because I don't think I could. Like, I mean, I find it hard enough keeping on top of just doing stuff as a hobby and kind of and like keeping myself creatively motivated at the best of times, like let alone if I've got to balance that with everything else that goes with it.
I think that's harder in certain senses because you're working two jobs there, but I think the thing with comedy, and the thing that makes it a bit less fun when it becomes a job in certain senses, is that when it becomes a means of surviving the world as opposed to a way of comprehending the universe, the fun in it sort of lost, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been interesting that there's come up in quite a lot in quite a lot of these chats I've done, because they've mostly been with kind of lower level people who aren't doing it full time. And like, yeah, a trend that comes up a lot is just the kind of like just remembering that it's a thing that you're meant to enjoy doing, rather than like this kind of big thing that you're doing to make a living. And obviously, yeah, when you are doing full time, you can't necessarily just kind of take time off because you're not feeling it. Like you have to, like you're obliged to be funny to eat, basically.
Yeah, it's hard. I think like I did a gig like the night of grandma's funeral last year. It's hard to take time off.
Mm.
And particularly, I think like if you are full time, even if like it took me so long to realise that the gigs will actually come.
Yeah.
But like when you are full time, even though the gigs will come, you still got that mindset of like, oh, what if they don't?
Yeah.
And when you're in that mindset, everything feels quite anxiety-ridden, do you know what I mean? You feel a bit like a mob boss, because you feel like at any minute, everything can just come crashing down.
Yeah, yeah.
So even if your calendar's looking healthy, you'll still, like, it'll still take you. You'll have to, like, physically pull yourself out of that and go, right, now back to writing, because your brain's still going, fuck, but what about, like, November? It's like, mate, it's February, chill. Like, you're full till November, chill.
Oh god, yeah, no, I'd be really bad for that. I mean, I'm bad at that as it is, as someone who like gigs like twice a month maximum and like has another income. But yeah, I'd be fucking awful with that. How long did it take you to kind of adjust to that from going? Well, so okay, first of all, how long had you been full time?
That's a good question. I finished my master's match about 2015-16. Was Brexit in 2016, yeah?
Brexit was 2016, yeah.
In 2016, so finished my master's then, and I moved in, so it's September 2016. since only 18, 19, 20. Yeah, 4 or 5 years.
Okay, yeah. So, and how long did it take you to kind of adjust to a point where you kind of got the hang of it, I guess?
Honestly, like, it's a never-ending process, isn't it? It's the same as that to-do list in quarantine.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't end. It doesn't stop. Like, it's forever a learning process, isn't it? And I think there's, like, two interesting things I can tell you with regards to that.
Yeah.
Number one is, like, I remember seeing, I won't name him, but I remember seeing a comedian I really, really, really liked. It was about 2 or 3 years into my career. At this point, I wasn't full-time. I wasn't even semi-pro.
Yeah.
I was doing, like, the odd bit of paid work every couple of months, you know, the odd middle 15 every month or so.
Yeah, yeah.
But we struggled, and it was somebody that I held up in really high regard, a full-time comedian. And, like, there's part of me that was relieved. There's part of me going, oh, God, it happens to the best of them. But there's also part of me going, oh, shit, this never ends. This never fucking ends. Like, at every particular point and corner of my life, with someone as creative as comedy, there's always someone who's better. There's always going to be that tougher gig, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But getting the hang of going, well, the worst thing about it is I was just getting used to it. Like, it's still, I'm five years into a job, and I'm only just getting to the point where I was really balancing my chasing the gigs and being happy enough with how many gigs were coming in and how much money I'm making with how much I was putting into creativity and crafting jokes. I was finally working on, like, balancing the times quite well, and then
now
I drink and wank a lot.
And then you were just completely banned from doing any of that.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't. That's it. It's hard to get the motivation, isn't it? Where you're just like, what the fuck can I use any of this again? That's why, like, at the very least, when I put the script together or the YouTube, I'm like, at least I know somebody will see this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I absolutely find that. I've been trying to focus on actually sort of like starting to write an hour, like just trying to use all this time to actually kind of do something with it. But yeah, with stand-up in particular, trying to write it, just it feels so kind of worthless, because, like, we don't know how long this is going to be.
You can't test it, can you?
Yeah, like most recent estimates assume it's going to be, like, at least a year at this point. Like, that may be extended, it might be less now, but yeah, it's really hard to motivate yourself to kind of write content that doesn't work in any other context. So you're someone, I mean, I suppose this kind of links into being full-time as well. You're someone who I've seen smash virtually every type of gig that I can think of. You do really well at our gig, which was obviously like a very kind of outspoken liberal lefty kind of gig. I also see you, like, smash virtually all kind of club sets and videos like that I've seen you do. I just wondered if you have, like, a different approach based on the kind of gig that you do. In terms of, like, preparing and writing for it, or whether they're, like, a whole different kind of beast altogether to do.
No, they're not a whole different beast. You're still presenting the same product, the same human being, and the same jokes. They're just, you know, coloured in slightly different, I suppose. Personally, I'm not the best at it. I'm not perfect. It's far better than me, but I pride myself on being able to play different rooms. And for me, like, it's not even just doing well, the success, or a competitive element. It comes from a deep place. Like, for me, like, I like that one thing. Like, jokes can bring people together, as corny as that sounds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And for me, aside from jokes, like, jokes and weed have been, like, an insight into cultures and people and groups that perhaps I'd not be normally able or would, like, those barriers would still be there where I wouldn't hang out with them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's something fucking wonderful. Like, there would be barriers there, and I think those barriers have been, for me, broken down through, like, weed and comedy, whether it was, like, in my first year at uni, and I was there with, like, this kid from, like, my side who's a bit of, like, a rude boy, an emo kid.
Yeah.
And, like, fucking two guys from London, and we're all smoking a joint in a bathroom together, and I was just like, these are four people who probably wouldn't really have met each other had we not decided to smoke a joint in the bathroom together. Or whether it be, like, you know, all these groups I play, all these places I go, whether it's coming to your night and mixing and playing and talking with gendered people, like parts of the LGBT community, whether it's going to, like, you know, a fucking working man's pub and fucking Skipton or fucking Wigan and talking to, like, a bunch of Brexit voters. These are, like, world's opinions and views that, if I didn't do comedy, I probably, unless, you know, I bumped into any people and asked you for a light, it turns out you smoke weed as well and we're fucking lobbed off to a bathroom. Like, I still think, like, I wouldn't perhaps have got the fortune to meet all of these people are, and I think that's quite a wonderful thing from comedy. And that's why, like, whatever the room I'm in, like, for me, comedy and art, art's translating a feeling, isn't it? And comedy's about making people feel good. So whatever the audience playing to,
yeah,
I still think you can be true to your principles while manipulating what it is you say. Like, that may sound two-faced.
No, not at all. Yeah, no, that, I totally get that, yeah.
But I think there's an art to rhetoric, and I think there's an art to stand-up comedy. That means, like, no matter what it is, I think by and large humans want the same thing. I think it just gets lost in a lot of the descriptive nonsense over the top of it. Comedy is a really strong tool for that, and I think, like, I'll give you a simple view that some people, some of your listeners might disagree with, but for me,
yeah,
this, if anything, was my defining moment as, like, who I'm going to be or what I wanted to be or what how I wanted to do comedy.
Yeah.
Was I did a joke where, like, when Brexit was happening, I said, Nick Griffin's, no, like, when UKIP started arising, so it was like 2014-15, I said, Nick Griffin, formerly of the BNP's, called UKIP racist. His reasoning is that they want to kick out just Eastern Europeans, whereas he wants to kick out everyone, so he's equal opportunity. I was like, Jesus Christ, Nick Griffin calling UKIP racist, talk about the pot calling the kettle a packy. And I remember being in certain big rooms, and I remember, like, people on the liberal left side of things laughing. I could see it, and I could feel it. Like, it was crazy. Like, I could feel that, like, people on the liberal left side of things were laughing at the irony.
Yeah.
And then the people who perhaps were a bit right were just laughing at the word packy. But I like that idea of, especially in those times, 2014 and 2016, it was the real build-up, the real beginnings of, like, those sort of what you now call the culture wars.
Yeah.
But that was happening in pubs as well, and it was happening, it was starting to happen online, it was becoming a real big thing.
Yeah.
And I took a lot of solace in the fact that, like, for that split second, you know, we were just laughing at the same thing, whether for different reasons or not. I thought it was very pure.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Do you think, has there been, so you started comedy, in the early 2010s, was it?
No, it was late 2012, August 2012 was when I did my first gig.
2012, yeah. So did you, I started around the same time, but I did it a lot less frequently. So I'm just curious, did you notice a shift in kind of general comedy audience atmospheres following the kind of Brexit vote? I'm assuming that, I'm using that as a kind of marker point, but obviously, yeah, it was a longer process than that.
It was in the run-up, really. I think it's really interesting. I think I'd be good at chairs and shit, because I think, like, genuinely from doing comedy, you talk to people and you get a way of the wind blowing.
Yeah.
Particularly comedy clubs are very, it's not scientific, obviously, but they're very good samples. And particularly when you try and put yourself to be as, to play to as many different audiences and go to Wake and Men's clubs and go to big city clubs and go to LGBT nights and go to left-leaning political nights and stuff like that. When you push yourself to go to all these different audiences, you do get a really fair random sample of what the UK has to offer. And you go to places that, you know, what certain commentators might have argued that London metropolitan elite sort of missed through the whole in the run-up of the Brexit campaign. But for me, I feel like through watching audiences, you could almost tell a tale of history from my perspective, because, like, when I started August 2012 in London, do you remember what August 2012 was? That was the London Olympics.
Oh, fuck, yeah. Of course it was.
And that was different, man. I think, like, this, you could feel in the air, or at least in the city then, there was just an air of hope.
Yeah.
Like, everyone was excited and shit, you know what I mean?
God, was that only 8 years ago? That feels like decades ago.
Yeah, it felt like even still then, like, sort of, we might have turned a corner over the recession and all that shit. Like, it was, the vibes was good for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then UKIP started rising, and then Brexit. I think in the run-up to Brexit, I told my brother, I said, I think it's going to be 52% out and 48% in.
Yeah.
Because I had to work that out, listening to the audiences at comedy clubs and just sort of making them up average. He's like, and you can do that all in your head, can you, just listening to them? And I was like, Sonny, if I couldn't, I wouldn't be a comedian. Like, you have to be able to hear those things. And he was like, all right, then. And then on results day, when it came out 52 out, 48 in, I texted him. I was like, mate, I told you. Before then, people were like, you know, you could do those polls and you'd get those results. And then after Brexit, people were less excited to admit that they voted Brexit. You know what I mean? It was only a few gigs I did I'd ask it every gig, just for my own interest.
Yeah.
I'd do my own little fucking survey, do you know what I mean? And probably better than most of the fucking pubs, I'll tell you that much.
Well,
it was only a few hardened areas that were really pro-Brexit, that they were really excited for it. But most of the big cities now, all of a sudden, were 90% Remain. A lot more of these, even like sort of more what you call towns and that.
Yeah.
Like, I would sort of think the Manchester, Greater North East, that they were a bit more, starting to get a bit more 50-50, even sometimes 55-60% Remain.
Yeah.
And then people just got sick of fucking talking about it.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, because I suppose when I asked if you want to talk about the politics and the lead up to the referendum,
yeah,
people actually did. Then in the aftermath of the referendum, when I'd asked, like, oh, so do you want to talk about the politics? The audience would be like, nah. and then just like, everything just fell apart, didn't it?
Yeah.
I found it hilarious. I was like, fuck, can you believe Donald Trump said this and we've got murder hornets and all this shit. And like, you can see in the audience's face, I'm just a bit tired of it now. Do you know what I mean? Like, and that does make your job hard, because how are you going to be funnier than the news?
Yeah, no, definitely. Because I noticed this, but I think I kind of chalked it off to just like the kind of age I was at the time, just sort of becoming more politically aware around the time that all the shit was going down. But yeah, there's definitely a huge change in people's attitude to kind of political kind of discourse and debate around that time. And yeah, I wasn't gigging loads around that time, but and I certainly wasn't doing anything political at that time. But yeah,
it's hard to analyze it in like retrospect, isn't it?
Yeah.
But one thing I would say is I think your assumptions or you got feeling there, right? I think like back then politics was more boring.
Yeah.
And you know what changed it? You made it all the more exciting. You'd be surprised what my theory.
What? Go on.
You remember. The Coney 2012 thing, that fucking changed politics forever.
Yeah, you know, now you mention that makes sense.
That took over the world, right? And that, like, for, it may seem a million miles apart. Like, I remember that shit was going mad on Bebo.
Yeah.
But, like, if you think of Dominic Cummings and the way he manipulated the votes and they got the data from that football fucking quiz on Facebook.
Yeah.
And you think about, like, not just data harvesting for me, but the way we as human beings now consume information.
Yeah.
There's too much. Like, there is so fucking much that, like, your brain is naturally more likely to just set, affirm there's us and them and not be as open-minded.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the time to fucking verify if everything's fucking true or not, or if everything's real or not. And then eventually, like, well, humans are humans at the end of the day, but when your whole life is essentially up there for your whole path, due to your own accord, you posting it onto there for everyone to analyze and scrutinize and shit like that. And I don't even just mean, like, stupid shit you said as a teenager. I mean, like, if you're in a fucking relationship and you break up or you divorce or whatever, or it's all up there.
It's all recorded.
Like, eventually, there's so much for people to, like, consume that. There's no boundaries anymore. Like, that boundary between backstage and front stage of life goes, but also that boundary between what's accepted and what's not goes. Now, like, you know what I mean? Who gives a fuck if he's, you know, potentially assaulted 27 women? Let's make him the president of the United States. Who gives a shit if he's got illegitimate children? He's, you know, he's funny, and everyone's got a crime behind them these days. Like, the threshold goes a lot lower.
Yeah.
When people don't have me to work with sometimes. When people don't have, like, when people have too much information to consume.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
When it's just external stimuli after external stimuli. It's very similar, I think, at least more diverse, though. But I think it's very similar to Huxley's A Brave New World.
I'll be honest, I've not actually read it, so just...
Oh, I give it a try. But basically, instead of who big brother 1984, the government always keeping watch on you, what we end up doing is we all keep watch on each other. And instead of, like, you know, being oppressed via a dearth of information, we're oppressed by an overload of it. Because, like,
that's really
everything seems real and fake at the same time. I think this is sort of the basic argument behind that fucking documentary. What was it called?
Which one, sorry?
The documentary maker, what's his name? The fucking... Oh, shit. I'm going to find it. It's a BBC... Hang on, I'm going to mess up.
I think I know the one you mean,
Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I think so. What's
like
he done?
The Iraq war in the financial system. And essentially, the argument is that, like, if you don't know what's real or fake at any given moment, you're quite easy to manipulate.
Yeah.
And it's what the Russian government have done, and it's now what sort of like the government are doing here.
Oh God, yes, yes, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And yeah, I think you're right. I think like the Kirby 2012 thing was probably not the first, but certainly one of the most kind of. It was a huge example of that, and how, and sort of making people aware of just how much you can use the internet as a way to kind of peddle agendas and peddle propaganda and that kind of thing.
Previously never had any political inclination.
Yeah, it's weird because I mean the internet's been like around for a while now, but it was, yeah, sort of starting to realise the actual scope of what it could be was, yeah.
The big difference was the big cut-off, I think, the world, what Kony 2012 represented in terms of the internet, less than news, what it represented in terms of the internet was, when we grew up with the internet, Johnny, oh man, it was class, like, because, like, just fucking learn shit, like, fucking, it was all inputs, do you know what I mean? You go on websites and you go on Wikipedia, you'd read, you go on LimeWire, because, oh, you download, like, fucking resources and hope it wasn't porn.
Yeah.
But nowadays, that switch was all of a sudden going from, like, consuming to producing.
Yes.
Don't be learning stuff. You know, put your opinion out there, you know, go on the streets and fucking save Uganda, even though you're a 14-year-old kid who doesn't have decent leave. Yeah, mate, you'll fucking defeat a militia in Uganda. That's a viable fucking option. And then it created these... I think that's what sort of made politics, you know, push it more away from the centre. I mean, not just... I mean, you know, me, I personally think it's to do with the failures of neoliberal capitalism as well.
Yeah, of course.
I think what's also pushed out further is that for both sides, the far left and the far right, things have never seemed more possible.
Yeah.
Because with that producing, you're getting, and with those sort of categorizers, you're getting pushed more and more into groups that reflect your standards. It's that sort of old echo chamber argument, but not necessarily. I'm not arguing it in a condescending way.
No, yeah, I do get what you mean. And like, it definitely feels like the aspirations of both kind of major ends of the political spectrum have like massively veered off in those directions. And I think there's definitely something to be said for.
But it's like, if you can fucking mobilize. What was it, like 40% of the rich world's young fucking teenage adolescents or whatever?
Yeah.
To go and try and fucking actually take over, well, try and rescue, try and fucking bring down Ugandan militia. Where are the limits, mate? Why not get, why couldn't you convince 50% of the country to vote for a reality star as president? Why couldn't you get 52% of the country to rip up a fucking decades-old trade agreement?
Yeah, no, definitely. Because, I mean, I don't remember much of the 2010 election, but certainly like the last three elections, particularly the last one, the internet has been used a lot more in those campaigns. And, yeah, I think you're right. I think after the Kony 2012 thing, people did start to realise just how they could use the internet in that way.
Yeah, 100%. And I think you see it with acts as well, you know what I mean, nowadays, and even me now that live stand-up's done, we're all sort of switching to online content and trying to build a following and trying to mobilise viewers to give us money and all this kind of shit.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. And I think it does have some benefits. Like, I think ultimately, after this is sort of calmed down a bit, it will make comedy a bit more accessible to people, but also there's a lot of shit there, and there's a lot of content from everyone. But everyone who's ever done an open mic gig, like starting a podcast or starting a YouTube series, there is that whole oversaturation thing that was already kind of a worry on the circuit. That's
but it's one of them. Like, people adapt. You know what I mean? It's a new world. You move with the times, or you get crushed by them, and it's one of them. When it doesn't necessarily ruin it, it just makes it like if you just have to really want it, you know what I mean? You gotta go looking for the comedy you wanna find, but there's so much out there, you will find yours.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's gonna be really interesting to see how the circuit evolves and changes after all this, because I don't think this kind of internet push is gonna go away necessarily. I think there will be people who carry on using this as their primary form of. I mean, there already were a few people doing that before this, but I think it will be like it'll just be interesting to see the effect this has in the long term.
Yeah, interesting indeed, whether that's a horrible interest, a tragic interest.
Exactly,
or a strengthening interest remains to be seen.
Yeah, exactly. Only time will tell. Going to change the subject a bit now. So, when you started comedy, so like your first gig, the first kind of bits you were writing, is that kind of similar in kind of style and context to what the stuff you're doing now. How do you find your voice, basically, is the roundabout question I'm getting to.
How did I find my voice? That was easier to answer the first way you put it, and now I'm like,
answer it the first way. Okay, so yeah, so going back to, yeah. So, okay, yeah, just take me through, like, your kind of, like, process for, like, okay, the first ever gig you did. Tell us about that, like, kind of writing process, like, booking, all of that.
Oh, yeah, so my first ever gig was Cavendish Arms.
Oh, yeah.
In Dockwell, Comedy Versions.
Yeah, I know the one.
And I emailed there. I was living in London. I was working at a bar for the Olympics.
Yeah.
And I emailed a few clubs. Well, not clubs, but like
open mics.
And Cavendish Arms got back to us. It was one on like the last day of the Olympics, or like the day after or something, or like a week after, a Wednesday.
Yeah.
It's quite a fun week. You know, I'd finished work for the month. It'd be a really fun month. Do my first ever gig. And I had the time, so I wrote my set. And I think I rehearsed it about 3,000 times in the mirror. I rehearsed it. My brother and his friend sat on the sofa. And I could tell, like, when they were looking at each other smiling, like, they weren't laughing, but they turned to each other smiling, like, yeah, that is clever. That is funny, isn't it? Like, they were still just sort of taken aback by the fact that I was even fucking trying it to begin with. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was a real nerves of shock for them. And so my opener was that Geordie Shore one, that was still popular at the time.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's not too, like, you know what I mean? That's not too different from the way I open now, is it? It's still sort of introducing the fact that I'm ethnic and from the Northeast and then that back.
Yeah.
Still, 8 years later, baffles people. And then you know, I can only remember two other jokes from it.
Yeah.
And I did a joke about everyone banging on about the Dark Knight Rising being a good film. I was like, the Dark Knight Rising, why would I pay 10 quid to go and see what I call an erection? I thought it was really good, but it got nothing. It got absolutely nothing.
Oh,
and then I tried to my finale, which was one of these sort of like poking holes in the system, I suppose, yeah, your Chris Rock bullet control type bit.
Yeah.
And the thing is, the place I was working, this bar, was a lot of context has to be provided before I get this. So if I just get this next joke of context, you're going to be like, right, well, we're stopping the interview. So we're going to be small, like the official after hours
right.
Headquarters for the official for the Jamaica team,
right.
Sponsored by Puma, through the Puma Yard.
Okay.
I was working with like loads of Afro-Caribbeans because like basically it was where all the Afro-Caribbeans were working front of house to give it more Jamaican feel.
Yeah.
And it was working back house. And on the food, they had like, when you went and got food, it was class. We got like, you know, kind of ting, jerk chicken, rice and coleslaw every day. But when we went there, there'd be like these big, old, like Afro-Caribbean ladies, like proper strong Caribbean accent. Like, hey man, what can I get you today? You want a curry goat? You want a jerk chicken? It was all like fun and all that.
Yeah.
And then if you go behind, like where we had to go and work, it was just like four Portuguese guys who were like 21 cooking it all and passing it through a window. But I thought it was fucking just so funny. But I was working there, and do you remember the John Terry thing with Anton Ferd?
I don't think I do, no.
So in football, like John Terry, the Chelsea captain,
yeah,
I've been like caught on camera calling Anton Ferdinand a fucking N-word.
Oh,
right?
Yes, yeah, I know the thing, yeah.
And Rio Ferdinand got in the papers because he called Ashley Cole shock act, brown on the outside, white on the inside.
Yeah.
For sticking up for John Terry in right. The court case. And then there was a police probe in Rio Ferdinand. So I told this joke to all the guys I was working with. I was like, what do you think? I'm going to try stand-up comedy. And they were like, all right. I told them this joke. And I was like, because John Terry just got off. Rio Ferdinand got police probe for using the same chalk ice. And it was like, I think that is political correctness gone mad, isn't it? When you get a police probe for calling someone a chalk ice. Like, my mom called me a chalk ice all the time growing up. And I never called for a police probe in her. But if she'd been caught on camera calling us a dirty fucking, and I used the N-word.
Right.
And they, at work, found it hilarious. They lost their shit. So I was like, all right, seal of approval. It's all good. And in like, well, so there's primarily like, every single person there was like white, Guardian reading sort of middle class. And I did the joke, and that was the joke I finished on after already getting silence in Dark Knight Rising. After previously doing quite well for 3 minutes. And sorry, I just got distracted there by somebody doing something outside my door.
That's right.
The clap in his fucking hell. Oh, God, I hate the NHS.
I'm just gonna leave that quote in with no context.
No, do it, mate, do it.
It's Raul Cody, NHS.
Everyone cancelled. So God, I already do it. The NHS is clapping. It's massively distracting us.
Oh, God, yeah.
I'd done 3 minutes quite well. I was well received. Then I did the Dark Knight Rises one that didn't do too well. So I moved on and I did this joke. And like everyone, dead silence. There's one guy who just fell off his chair screaming at the back. And it was one of the black guys, one of the Afro-Caribbean guys I worked with at the Pumion, who'd come to watch. He was a film director. His name's Isaac.
Yeah.
And he just fell off his chair at the back lap. And everyone just kind of turned, awkwardly looked at him, and then awkwardly looked back and just kind of went, like, sort of laughed painfully. And then I left the stage for that. But it was all right. It went well enough first time to make me continue.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it?
My boy, to be honest, I think from then on now, it's still, by and large, the arc of my ship, the arc of my five, is to like the 5 to the 20, 30. It's still the same, really, on the circuit. And so I thought I introduced myself, I let them know who I am. I validate all their prejudices in certain ways about being Asian, about being Geordie.
Yeah.
But I flip with that a little bit. And then I sort of moved a bit more. So I used to end it on the really heavy political stuff, which I now know not to do. You should end with your best, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I'll drag the more political stuff in the middle and then end on a really big laugh.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like finding my voice has mainly been just learning the craft side of things.
Mm.
But the person who was on stage then is still probably, I would argue, looking at that set and thinking about it, the same person as he is now, but less refined and less wise, just in terms of, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
28 and 21, or 28 and 20 years old, very different perceptions on life and what's important.
Yeah, of course.
Essentially, it's the same soul.
Right.
Connecting, say, my 20 now or my hours now, that 5 then.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why I love stand-up so much, and what it probably gave us is the fact that stand-up, more than anything, has allowed me to be myself.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I think I grew up in quite a rough area. I went to quite a posh school. I was brown in both of those scenarios. I had a funny accent when I was out in Newcastle. And on comedy, I can just be me. And that is incredibly liberating as well. Like, do you know what I mean? I can be a bit of a stoner, a bit of a philosopher, somebody who's interested in politics, wrestling, hip-hop. I can be Geordie, I can be Indian. I can be all these things. And it doesn't feel like it's a contradiction, or it doesn't feel like people are taken aback by that in the wrong way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Is it surreal being able to essentially monetize just being you?
I've never thought of it that way, but when you put it that way, that's quite ego inflating, isn't it? Yeah, it's, I can't monetize it that much, otherwise I'd be a lot bigger, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, of course.
That is quite surreal, actually, now I think about it. Yeah, sort of, I'm the brand, innit? I suppose it's actually quite dangerous, really, because sometimes, you know, the brand, I suppose the person on stage, you hear some of these stories, and sometimes the person on stage can filter into your real life, and particularly when you're running off all that energy that you get on stage, sometimes, you know, after gigs, you do the dumbest shit. And perhaps that wouldn't be so much if you weren't crafting as your day-to-day job a more extreme version of yourself.
Yeah, that makes it. That must be a very weird identity shift, especially if you're doing it like full time.
Yeah, and I think that is trouble because there's no boundary between work and play, and then you get yourself in all sorts of trouble.
Yeah, I imagine particularly in like the Fringe, that must be really, because if you are doing the same thing.
I've done Fringes where I've been pissed for the entire thing, man. It's not good. It's not a good habit to get in. But yeah, that can get out of hand. But then you just. Do you know what I mean? Like, I did 2 hours of, like, true stories.
Yeah.
That were just fucking mental stories. That weren't just, like, politics or social comedy. Just 2 hours of mad true stories.
Yeah.
Then you get 2 hours out of it. It's hard. And then when you start comedy at 20, there's no real fucking boundary between being a kid and being an adult.
Yeah.
So you still be, like, 27 at the Fringe being like, let's go make fucking more stories. It's getting next year's show on the fucking, on the go. And that can then debilitate everything on that you sort out, you know, your taxes or just, you know, getting your right or whatever, or just being productive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there is this theory of it. I mean, I've only ever heard it in reference to kind of like rock bands generally, but I imagine the same thing applies. The kind of like the year that you kind of start, not necessarily getting famous, but like start kind of getting like actually kind of like stuck into it, and it sort of becomes a viable option for a career is the year that you just kind of stop aging?
No, for me it's slightly different because I mean, I've aged very quickly because I mean, I probably drank more before I got into comedy.
Yeah.
Because like I grew up in Tyneside, and then like, do you know, I mean, I grew up in Tyneside. I was a club promoter at like 15.
Yeah.
So I've been exposed to alcohol like massively, and like, actually, do you know what? To be fair, I did drink a fucking lot through my early days.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it really became, I suppose, yeah, like that's a thing. I can't get too pissed now. Like, I'll never vomit or fucking KO. That's like a thing of the past.
Right.
Which is worrying. Like really worrying.
Yeah.
Sometimes. But I can always keep all the function by and large of my senses, which is quite alarming, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think like because of that increased childhood exposure.
Yeah.
And maybe I should count my lucky stars because that increased exposure from like 14, 15. Like I was going to clubs as 13, 14, binge drinking. Then I was working in clubs like 16, 17, 18. Then I had uni. I was getting money from the government to get pissed. And then I started doing comedy where I'm getting offered a drink as soon as I turn up to work. Like there was about a decade of, without me realizing, without dependency really, like alcoholism essentially.
Yeah.
But I think that decade, particularly through the time where I was growing up, the exposure to it has made me, it's really, I think the reason hangovers get worse as you age isn't because of like, it's because of wear and tear.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you're right.
The first few years of comedy, but because I had like 6 years before, it's also going mad. it's just really like sort of game over for us now, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas I think most probably full-time at 28, 29, perhaps wouldn't be having the struggles I'm having. They'd still be like taking full advantage of that and enjoying themselves. But for me, it was like, I don't know, when you're gigging 4 or 5 nights a week, you treat every night like an adventure away in a new city where you can have a few pints, and then you've got to get on a fucking megabus the next day.
Yeah.
Things can get out of hand very quickly. I mean, that's 4 or 5 times a week. And everything in between is buses, not beds.
Yeah.
I've got neck problems in Britain, man. An old man in a 29-year-old's body.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, I'm quite lucky in this, as I only really gig, like I say, like, usually about twice a month maximum, unless there's, like, something going on. And yeah, I do struggle to like even on times when like I've been in dry bars, I really struggle to get the nerve to actually perform without drinking. And I've realised if this was a thing I was doing full time, that would be like incredibly bad.
That and smoking were really, I used to like chain smoke like 3 cigs before going on stage, and that's just like terrible because cigs actually like when that withdrawal starts happening on stage, that just makes you more anxious.
Oh.
So it's not going well like the first 2-3 minutes. When I've managed to give up nicotine, it's not going well in the first 2-3 minutes. I'm calm. I handle it.
Yeah.
There's no nerves. I know I'll win them over. And by the end of it, they fucking love it even more because I've built it up so much.
Yeah.
And they can see the work I put in to win them over.
Yeah.
But like, when I smoke too much, I go and sit 2-3 minutes in, if it's not going on, there's a chance I panic.
Yeah.
And with drink, that sort of thing, like, you can't smoke on stage, can you? It's not like the good old days. You fucking chain smoke tabs on stage and kill unborn children and shit. But anyway, I'd have like, that's a habit I found myself in. So while it wasn't dependency, do you know what I mean? Like, there was a limit. Whenever I'd fill in those sheets at the doctor's, it was never like I got to the point where it was like I'd turn over and it'd be like, do you ever need a fucking swig of vodka to get out of the bed in the morning? I was like, yep, all the time. That was like still a no. But by the fact that like 4 days a week when I'm going to work, I need 2 pints or a pint and a half just to settle my nerves.
Yeah.
But also, if I have 2.5 pints or 3 pints, I can start slurring my words and fucking knock a little margin off my performance. Oh, for fuck's sake, it was such a tightrope to walk, and it wasn't a very good habit I got into.
No.
I sort of got into it. You get into it without realizing, don't you? That's the nature of addiction and habit.
That's exactly it, yeah, because I mean, I started comedy when I was 16, and I kind of avoided just going to the bar at all because I was worried that if I did, they would ID me and I'd be kicked out, which did. Which did happen once. So yeah, I had shitloads of caffeine beforehand. Like before you get into the pub, that's how I managed it then. Which probably wasn't any more healthy, come to think of it. But yeah, then as soon as I was old enough to like actually buy alcohol there, and then yeah, that became my new thing. And then it's a rare enough occasion that like whenever I managed to do a gig completely sober, like the most recent time was. load of train delay, so I got to the gig like 2 minutes before I was on. So like I wasn't drunk till then. It's a noteworthy occurrence, and it shouldn't be noteworthy to be sober when you're working.
It's you know, I don't know why, Johnny. I think maybe I like to play devil's advocate, but I'm off and off. Like,
yeah,
I see it, and as I'm getting older, I'm making analyses on this. And for me, it's like a job as well. I'm thinking about it in such a scientific way that I would recommend to any comedian to try and get some fucking like Buddhist or Hindu thinking or reading done about like just, you know, controlling your mind and meditation and nerves and holding them and that kind of shit. I think it's measurably valuable. I think it's measurably important. But at the same time, I'm not sure I would have done my 20s any other way, and I'm quite disappointed that, so, well, it's not, I mean, fucking hell, first world problem and a half. I was sort of a little bit upset that the last years of my 20s, and I've gone on all these towns and cities all over Europe, getting pissed, smoking dope, telling jokes, fucking meeting people, learning new things and coming across different worldviews. Like, I'm pretty gutted that last sort of phase of it, just about to 30, like, it really has just been taken away from us. Again, first world problems.
Yeah.
But, like, for me, getting into it, like, again, I got into it before the internet. Like,
yeah.
I stayed up watching Comedy Central at Comedy Store on Wednesday, Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. on, like, fucking Paramount back then.
Yeah.
And the stories and shit they were telling then, the club atmosphere, like, I felt that.
Yeah.
And so, like, for me, it was still meant to be a bit of an adventure, do you know what I mean? It was still meant to be a bit rock and roll.
Yeah.
And for me, that's always the way I've been. I've always preferred the artist who fucking... nobody ever knows them when they're around and they end up fucking like dying alone and drunk or some shit. then one who's like, nobody remembers Engelbert Humperdinck, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, you know I mean? Like, I agree.
Was number one in the 60s all the time. He was selling out stadiums. He was like, in the 60s, everybody knew Engelbert Humperdinck.
Yeah.
By the 70s, nobody knows who he fucking is, but... how many of these fucking rock and roll stars can you name?
Yeah.
And I would never claim to be on their level, but...
yeah, yeah.
I got to enjoy life a little bit by, like, prioritising the live experience and prioritising those after-show drinks and chats. Yeah. Even if it did cause fucking total anxiety and mental health issues, I'd treasure that so much more than I treasure fucking trying to get likes and clips and patrons. And maybe that's because I'm not as good at it. And that is... evident both in my finances and in my numbers, but I don't know, maybe it's just the way I was grown up and socialized. Like, for me, it was a life experience. For me, that was meant to be a bit of a
rock
and roll atmosphere too.
I think
doing comedy and being in the green room, do you know what I mean? Like, if I wanted to be the most ambitious of professionals, if I wanted to be the number one of the one, I would have gotten a fucking drug dealing or finance or some shit, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But I wanted to be the full jetter, I wanted to skive, I wanted to take the piss.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely, I agree with you. And you tell what, I feel incredibly sorry for anyone who's going to be starting uni if this carries on to the new term, because I imagine having Freshers Week in lockdown.
Do you know, I was thinking at first how class would it have been, like, because for me, I still got shit I can do. I'm now at a different phase of my life where my brain's not concerning. Like, my brain's always going to be anxious if I'm fucking playing Oblivion or FIFA or drinking games with the fucking me flatmates. My brain is still going to back going, yeah, you could be fucking reading a book, you could be brushing up your Italian, you could be like learning Arab Premiere Pro, you could be writing some scripts for your YouTube videos.
Yeah.
But if I was back at uni, my mindset was different. Then I wasn't thinking about being a comedian. I wasn't thinking about the future. I was just thinking about then and there.
Having fun, yeah. And I think that is a very important...
get loads of bevvies, loads of fucking weed. And I've like just got my own fucking flat with like 8, 9 of my best pals and a tower full of people I love. Like, everyone I love within a 1 mile radius. Oh, that would have been the dream.
Yeah.
Freshers Week, yeah. Going in university, mate. I'm going to make a TikTok actually about trying to recreate Freshers Week through vlogs.
Oh, nice one. Yeah, that'd be good.
Fairy liquid as a perfume party. Just fucking let VK linger on the floor. On your daily walk, find a recreate being on a pub crawl by accidentally pissing on a war memorial. When you go to Aldi, try and skip the queue by claiming guest list of VIP.
One more question. What's the best advice you've ever received in terms of your comedy? Or if it's easier, what advice would you give to a younger Raoul doing comedy?
Focus more on the Oh, I couldn't give myself that advice. Nah, I don't believe it. Part of me wants to say focus on the art more than the job.
Yeah.
The gigs will come. You're talented enough. Like, building the brand isn't what you need to worry about.
Yeah.
Part of me doesn't want to say that, you know what I mean? Because if I had focused more on the art, then I would have relied on, you know, I eventually might have given up, or I would have relied on doing something that went big.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually really enjoy just being sort of, you know, not particularly well known, but earning enough to be a sick comic.
Yeah.
And just talk about a bit. I think the best advice I give any younger comic, and the best advice I've ever received, Bethany Black apparently told Tom Short, who apparently told me, well, Tom Short did tell me.
Yeah.
I think he quoted Bethany Black. And it was the best. Bethany Black for me is like a bit of an idol, really, because I think she's
great,
like,
yeah.
For me, like, for me, she defines what comedy should be,
yeah.
What comedians are, like, because for me, doing this job, like, when I first started, I was getting overnight megabus to London, like, I've slept at Shute Hill Station, waiting to fucking go to gigs and shit,
yeah.
6 a.m., do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So for me, like, I don't give a fuck about anyone who, like, all this shit about free speech in comedy, I think it's bollocks, I think it's fucking bollocks, I make jokes fucking about everyone, and I'm still playing, do you know what I mean, left-wing politically correct nights, I don't, like, if you're a comedian, I don't give a fuck what gigs you've not done. Like, that doesn't impress. What matters to me is what gigs you have done.
Yeah.
Like, Andy White, you know who he is?
I've heard of him.
The black comedian from the West Midlands. He's mixed race, but yeah, he got accidentally booked to play the BNP party conference. So went in there, man, fucking smashed the shit out of it. Didn't fucking blink. Just went there, did his 20, got a fucking standing ovation, a round of applause. That, for me, is the type of urban legend I fall in love with.
Yeah.
And that's the type of comedian I respect. And Bethany Black is like that, you know what I mean? Like, for who she is, she can go in any room fucking tear it up. It does not matter who she's playing to. Like, big clubs, small clubs, skip in London, wherever, mate, she can turn it on. And I really respect that in a comedian. For me, that's everything a comedian should be.
Yeah.
And her advice, apparently, to Tom, again, might have been quoting a different Beth or fucking...
Yeah.
I could be quoting a completely different person, in which case I'm completely sorry. But apparently what she said was, for if you're doing a 30-minute set for the first 15 minutes, you need to give them what they want. They see you and they're forming all sorts of conclusions. And you sort of, you need to fall in line with those conclusions. But then for the next 15 minutes, you should have won them over so much that you can take them wherever the fuck you want to go.
I love it. I've not heard that before. That's really good.
Have you not heard that?
No, I've not. I've heard like similar mantras before, but I've not heard it put like that.
Yeah, that for me was like a real key to like how to do circuit comedy perfectly.
That is phenomenal advice. Thank you very much.
And that was Raoul Coley. Like I said, I really enjoyed having this chat. I hope you enjoyed listening as well. Raoul has such a unique voice in comedy, and it's a pleasure to really hear his thoughts on the ins and outs of the industry and the wider political landscape at the time. I really enjoyed having this chat. Thank you for listening. If you like Raoul, there's a few places you can find content of his. I particularly like to draw your attention to the BBC podcast he had, which I believe is still available on the iPlayer, Comic Sanskrit. I will have a link to that in the description below. So yeah, do absolutely check that out. It's fantastic. And I will link to any other ways you can follow and find Raoul on the internet, Twitter, social media, and all that kind of thing. And also, if you would like to support Blizzard Comedy, you can do that via PayPal or Patreon. Again, both links in the description below. I should also apologise, this episode did come out slightly later than intended because of our live stream that happened last week, so all my attention was kind of going into that. We are going to be making that a regular thing, so for now on, the last Monday of every month, we are going to be doing an episode of Blizzard Comedy's Broadcast Avalanche, which is our take on a topical panel show format, but with everything that you know and love of the Blizzard Comedy ethos. I don't know when the next Blizzard Comedy Archives episode is going to be. I am working on it now, but that may also be a little bit later because of I'm focusing mainly on the live streams now, but yeah, if you are enjoying these, please do let me know. I will carry on making them. But they may be less frequent. So yeah, thank you again very much for watching. I'm going to stop fucking waffling now, you prick. Thank you very much for listening, not watching, and I hope you have a safe rest of your day. And just lives in general. But I hope to speak to you again before the end of them. All right, bye.